The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We have the highest trade deficit
China
with
ate
Mexico.
Your lunch, down all right, 8%. China ate your lunch, Joe. And no wonder your son goes in and he takes out billions of dollars to manage. He makes millions of dollars. And also, just out of curiosity, the mayor of Moscow's wife gave your son $3.5 million. What did he do to deserve it?
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Boy, I feel like I'm in a time machine, huh? That is a flashback. You may hate Donald Trump. You may love him. You got to admit, it's entertaining. I mean, there's something about that exchange. It just, I don't know, it makes you want to listen. Of course, we shouldn't hate anybody. We have to love everyone. We got to pray for the president and for former President Trump. Let's hope we get this issue right. We will talk about China coming up. I don't know if you remember that interaction between President Biden and the former president. That was on a debate stage. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. China, I've been covering them from their military exploits to their espionage to their theft of our intellectual properties. Will China, as President Trump warned, be eating our lunch? I'll break that down coming up in a little bit. But first of all, welcome. It's good to be here with you today. It's always good to hang out. We have a lot to talk about. Let me give you a number that brings you right into the conversation so you can use it anytime. It's 888-914-9149, and it's always good to talk with you. Let me fill you in on some news, all right, what's happening around the country and around the world. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has just signed a bill that will forbid men, who think that they're women, from competing on women's sports teams in public schools. He's taking heat for it. To me, it's just common sense, right? I'm sure a lot of girls in those schools are probably glad about it. He signed it yesterday, and it was the timing, you have to think about what yesterday was. You might have missed it. Yesterday was the first day of so-called Pride Month, right? It's Pride Month. So other governors such as Kristi Noem of South Dakota and the governors of North Dakota and Kansas, they've all vetoed similar bills, usually after, pressure has been applied to them by some sort of corporate interest. But DeSantis got pressure from the NCAA. And according to ABC News, when the Florida legislature was considering the measure in April, the NCAA said it would commit to championship games to locations where hosts can commit to providing an environment that is both safe, healthy, free of discrimination. But Governor DeSantis, he told Tucker Carlson the other night, hey, if the price of having a tournament is that I have to deny equal opportunity to hundreds of thousands of young girls and women athletes throughout my state, throughout Florida, then look, I am not willing. I'm much more willing, he said, to stand with these girls. And I say bravo. Good for you, Governor DeSantis. You're right. If I was a parent of one of those daughters, I would certainly want rationality and truth to reign. WFTV in Orlando, they did a report on this transgender sports ban. I want to just get you up to speed on everything you need to know. Check this out.
Morning. Standing in front of students at Trinity Christian Academy, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill making Florida the sixth state to ban transgender athletes from girls' sports.
I can tell you this, in Florida, girls are going to play girls' sports and boys are going to play boys' sports.
The ban, which was tacked onto a charter school bill in the final hours of the legislative session, requires students to play sports according to their gender on their birth certificate. Lawmakers admit that it's not been an issue in Florida, but say isolated examples from other states are concerning.
Everyone should have the chance to participate in sports, but they need to compete where it's most fair.
Runner Selena Soule came in from Connecticut for the event. Soule had to compete against transgender athletes back in her home state and says that was unfair.
It is, because the male physiology is just a little bit more dominant. He's a little faster, and it's going to cost a lot of young girls who had the potential for scholarships not to get them, to lose a lot of those particular races. It's just common sense. I don't know how this insanity has become, normal today. I sit back and I look at this just very objectively speaking, just the optics of just looking at it, and it makes no sense. I'm sure you probably agree. Professor Robert George, who is one of the most brilliant men I know, an incredible Catholic. I love him. He was on Facebook this morning. Let me share with you what he said. Just one final thought on this. He says that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis continues to stand up to the woke plutocracy while other Republican governors cave in and they grovel, he'll not only be reelected, he will win the Republican nomination for the presidency. I can see him running. I definitely can see him running. You know, people want somebody who will stand up and speak the truth. Somebody who will say, this is wrong, and here, I am voicing what is right. You know, and I love our nation's bishops. I'm not here to throw stones at it at all, but that's one of the complaints you often hear. You want people to stand up and say, hey, we have a problem with X, Y, and Z. I think we need good leadership in the church. We need it in our government. We need it in our homes. We need it at every level. People want to follow truth, right? And let's pray for those good leaders that are now under attack, those who are vacillating, those who are capitulating to the, you know, the woke plutocracy, as Robert George points out. I love him. But note the contrast between DeSantis on the one hand and Mike Pence and Kristi Noem and Aja Hutchinson on the other hand, when push came to shove. And you know, Professor George points out, I think it's a great insight. I should get him on. We'll talk to him maybe in the days ahead about this. I always appreciate his great insights. Hey, just one other note here. And I do this with caution. I do it with balance. And later in the week, in fact, tomorrow, we'll dive into the whole UFO phenomena a little bit. The New York Post reported today that there's this long-awaited report that the Pentagon is compiling on UFOs. It could be released as early as Tuesday. Congress wants this, and they want to know what the Department of Defense, what the Pentagon knows about, you know, unidentified aerial phenomena invading U.S. airspace with impunity. Is it extraterrestrial? Is it, you know, foreign nation and an adversary? Is it ours? They want to know. So this comes as more videos are showing unidentified objects that appear to defy the laws of gravity. You know, they just the G forces that these things can turn and move at, the speeds they can travel. It's just it's mind boggling right now. It would portend a great technological leap. But funds for the report were contained in a $2.3 trillion Corona relief package that was signed by the President Trump back in December. So everyone has been looking forward to this. 6 months have gone by. We could see next week. But the law started the clock ticking. 180-day countdown for the U.S. intelligence agency under the direction of the Director of National Intelligence to inform Congress what they know about the existence of these unidentified aerial phenomena or unidentified flying objects. So it'll be I can't wait to read it. I think it's going to be very telling. The City News in Canada, they talked to an expert on this report, and he explained why the study should not be laughed off, as a lot of people are probably going to do.
It could be released as early as tomorrow, detailing exactly what the U.S. government knows about UFOs. This report is going to come after a four-year drip of government admissions. The U.S. Military has admitted that its pilots have had encounters with this is the actual video, objects that they don't know what they are, objects that defy the laws of physics as we understand them. Weighing in on this, I thought was interesting, weighing in during a CBC interview recently, was Canadian retired astronaut Chris Hadfield. Chris Hadfield said, quote, "Obviously, I've seen countless things in the sky that I don't understand, but to see something in the sky that you don't understand and then to immediately conclude that it's intelligent life from another solar system is the height of foolishness and the lack of knowledge." Now, I agree with him in that I don't think you should make that immediate leap to say we're looking at aliens, but I also take a bit of issue that he would phrase it that way, in that it might persuade people not to look at an issue that the U.S. government's taking very seriously, that I think we should be taking seriously, right?
Yeah, why not take it seriously? And this is why we investigate these things, right?
Dr. Stephen Barr, he's an astrophysicist from the University of Delaware, is going to join me tomorrow. There is a Catholic gathering of scientists. They're having a conference on extraterrestrial life, and we'll look at all this through the prism of our Catholic faith. It will be a revealing conversation tomorrow, so make sure you join me. And I'm going to call you to prayer too on an issue here. I mean, it is Pride Month, and you might have somebody in your life that has same sex attraction. You might be that person. The church is very clear. We're all to love one another. The teachings on homosexuality are pretty well laid out by the church. So in April, the State Department allowed U.S. embassies around the world to fly the rainbow flag on the same pole and directly beneath the U.S. flag. And according to the New York Times, this was done before May 17th, which they said, you know, is the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. And, you know, they can have them up all throughout the month of June. And somehow, you know, it got designated as Pride Month. Well, you know, the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See hosts, they ended up hoisting their own flag. And they tweeted this out at the same time. So, again, this is not the Holy See, but this is the embassy, the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See. Here's their tweet. They said, "The U.S. Embassy to the Holy See celebrates hashtag Pride Month. With the Pride flag on display during the month of June, the United States respects the dignity and equality of the LGBTQI+ people. LGBTQI+ and rights are human rights." And now, look, if that's not a slap in the face of the Catholic Church, you know, I don't know what is. But here's something else. One just tangential note here. There are no rainbow flags being flown in any Islamic country. Congressman Jeff Duncan of South Carolina has introduced the Old Glory Only Act, which would allow embassies to fly only the United States flag. And I think that is a great idea. Lucas, why don't you open your mic for me, because I can't read that on my chat right here. Go right ahead.
Yeah, well, Drew, I think you were making a good point there. And when I first saw the picture on Twitter of the U.S. Embassy with the Pride flag, I did a double take, and then I realized, oh, wait, the U.S. Embassy to the Vatican isn't actually related to the Vatican. And I think that's an important distinction to make and help clarify to people that just because they are ambassadors to the Vatican does not mean that the Catholic Church is in any way approving of what they're doing. They're a separate entity. So just important to keep in mind, you know, so we don't have
it's a great point, and I'm glad you underscored it. It is important. I wanted people to know that, because when they see this, they think, oh, the Catholic Church is doing this. No, it's the U.S. Embassy to the Catholic Church. But just put it on your radar in case you hear it, and you might see more of it. In fact, tomorrow I think I'll talk about Pride Month. We'll take a look at what's happening, not just here in this country, but around the world. So join me. I'll dive into that issue. I'll unpack it for you so you'll know where we stand, where the church stands, and how we can approach all this with both love, charity, and respect for the dignity of our brothers and our sisters. China, I want to talk about them for a moment, too. I've been, as I said, monitoring China. You heard the president at the beginning of the segment here talk about how they're going to eat our lunch. That was the former president. Washington Free Beacon reported yesterday that China Daily, that's a newspaper that's run by the Chinese government, it paid millions of dollars for advertising and printing over the past 6 months to American newspapers and to magazines, including Time Magazine. I was shocked when I saw that. The LA Times, Chicago Tribune, Foreign Policy Magazine. Those are some of the papers and magazines that China's pumping advertising dollars into. Most recently, as part of a $700,000 advertising campaign, Time published China Daily articles touting a very controversial drone maker accused of helping the government surveil Uyghurs and boost the Chinese Communist Party's, you know, last 5 years of economic growth, their plan. And this is all part of the Chinese government's plan to peddle its influence around the world. We are in a battle for the 21st century. I would agree with Joe Biden on that point. There's no doubt about it. We are in a race against China right now. It seems to be working. You probably saw John Cena. He's a wrestler and an actor. He apologized to the Chinese audience. He did it in Mandarin, which is pretty impressive, because he made the mistake of saying that Taiwan is a country. And he went ahead and, you know, kowtowed and begged forgiveness for having done that, because China does not recognize Taiwan's sovereignty. China, though, has bigger plans. They already have a military base in the African in the African country, and they're mining in that country. They are really a strong presence over there. They've got a base, I think, on the eastern coast along the Red Sea. There was a report a couple weeks ago that I saw they're trying to establish another one somewhere in the Atlantic, and that, of course, would boost their naval presence just across the pond, right? So they're also spending tons of money for military buildup. But China's not without its problems, too. Don't think that they're implacable or that you should fear. They're losing population. I mentioned the other day that they now have raised the allowance for couples to go to three children because they realized that they're on a brink of demographic disaster. Back in 2019, Joe Biden, he laughed off the idea that China would eat our lunch. You know, he thought they, come on, they're not real competition. At least that's what he claimed. Listen to Joe Biden.
China is going to eat our lunch? Come on, man. They can't even figure out how to deal with the fact that they have this great division between the China Sea and the mountains in the east, I mean, in the west. They can't figure out how they're going to deal with the corruption that exists within the system. I mean, they're not bad folks, but guess what? They're not competition for us.
So a few months ago, CNBC ran a report, and they just showed how radically changed Joe Biden apparently is. He changed his tune on this. Check this out.
I was on the phone for two straight hours with Xi Jinping.
U.S. President Joe Biden issued a stern warning about China on Thursday, calling it America's most serious competitor and saying the U.S. must up its game or China would, quote, eat our lunch.
If we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch.
Biden's comments came during a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators on the need to upgrade U.S. infrastructure. The president referenced a two-hour phone call he had with Chinese President Xi Jinping the night before, his first with Xi since taking office, and how China was ramping up its railroad and electric vehicle technology, urging that similar infrastructure improvements were among the areas the U.S. needed to focus on in order to compete.
Yeah, James Carafano is a leading expert in national security and foreign policy challenges at the Heritage Foundation, longtime contributor to the program, and always good to talk with him. James, thanks for your time. Good afternoon.
Yeah, you know, I can tell you what changed.
Tell me.
You know, this is like the little Nancy Drew clues all spun through your monologue there, which is what changed is he has a $6 trillion package on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
And they know that Americans are all worked up about China. And so all of a sudden, China becomes the excuse of why we need to spend $6 trillion.
Wow.
Now, the reality is that $6 trillion is not going to help us compete with China. In fact, it's going to make our economy less competitive and less dynamic. What it will do is implement all the progressive wish list that all the little Obama acolytes that are holding in the Oval Office have. And that's all that matters to them. So it's not about Joe Biden waking up and discovering that China is a threat to the United States. It's much like every other issue that they try to do is how can we enlist this issue to help push the most radical political agenda in American history?
Yeah, so let's talk about that point, James, because American news outlets, of course, are being paid. They're going to take the advertising dollars to publish articles. But from the Chinese government, from the Chinese government mouthpiece, to me, it's almost reprehensible. How deeply does that corruption reach into our society? Do you have a problem with that? And what do you make of their attempt to use our own media to advance their agenda?
Well, you know, there is this thing called like flash to bang, right? This is you see the lightning of the horizon, and then but you don't hear the crash until seconds later, right?
Right.
So we had this kind of incessant debate in the United States between the panda huggers and the panda haters that, don't worry, as China matures, it'll become a more responsible nation and that can trim everything else, and all relations were normalized. And the panda haters say, no, you're out of your mind. The more power and resources the Chinese Communist Party has, the more dangerous they're going to become. And, you know, that argument's relatively over as, you know, the panda huggers are hugging the panda haters now. But there was a long period in our history where it was, you know, it was kind of like our policy was the same as like the Blazing Saddles movie. You know, don't shoot Mongo. You might make him mad, right?
Right.
You know, don't antagonize the Chinese. And we said, so we were bending over our backwards to accommodate Chinese. And people thought they were going to make a ton of money in China. And so we still have the lag of that in American media and public policy in the private sector, where people think they have to kowtow, no pun intended, to the Chinese. A good example of this is this film, Fast and Furious. So the star of the movie angers China, so he immediately grovels and apologizes. And then what happens? The movie absolutely crashes and burns in China, and they make no money off it anyway. So you humiliate yourself in front of the Chinese, and you prove that you have no interest or you know, no real profit in doing this. So this doing business with China is good for us. I mean, increasingly, that's just not proven to be true.
Yep.
And these people are just slow to the table. Just like in the 1950s, you still had people who were defending Stalin. You know, we were 10 years into the Cold War. Yeah, it's nonsense for people to be saying nice things about China.
So the future of China, Joe Biden and President Trump, in a debate said, hey, China's going to eat our lunch. Biden's now apparently changing his tune, but you make a good case for why. They have bases, you know, on the Atlantic coast off of Africa. They're putting roads in Rwanda. They're getting all these mining rights throughout the continent. And there was a report based on a book from a woman who'd survived one of these Uyghur concentration camps. She said that China actually has eyes on taking over Europe by 2050. That's not that far away. It's pretty brazen, if indeed that's the case. Is there any way for us to know, you know, what's real and what's not? And what do you see in terms of their own expansion in the next couple decades?
So there are two things which are fundamentally true. One is the base doctrine of the Chinese Communist Party is civil-military fusion, which means that every instrument, not just every instrument of government, but every instrument in the society, including the private sector, are there to perpetuate the interests and the actions of the Chinese Communist Party. So everything China does is potentially to enrich the Chinese Communist Party and traces back to that. So you may say, well, I'm not dealing with them, I'm dealing with whatever, but that university could well be working directly for the Chinese military, which is working directly for the Chinese Communist Party. So everything, as far as the Chinese concerned, is on the table for them to gain and accumulate power. And their fundamental ambition is imperial. It is, if we gain security and prosperity and eternal safety by controlling everything we touch. So their idea is to control all their markets, all their sources of resources, all the lines of communication that can connect that, much in the way that, you know, 18th and 19th century empires thought they could control things. So they're literally trying to build an empire. And make very clear, this is an empire which exists for one purpose, to serve the Chinese Communist Party. You know, their idea is to carve out a large chunk of the world, which essentially would be one grand suburb of Beijing. Now, we can debate whether they can do that, but make no mistake, that's what this is about. It's about carving out a part of the planet and putting it directly under the control of the Chinese Communist Party for the sole benefit of the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, James, I want to thank you for your time and, of course, for your insight. We'll have to catch up. Again, this story's not going away. Of course, it continues to develop, but I appreciate you being here. It's James Carafano. He's a leading expert in national security and foreign policy challenges at the Heritage Foundation. Stay with me when we come back. I'll tell you what's happening with a giant mosque that's being built. You'd be surprised where. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show is here for you right here.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, quick programming note. In about 30 minutes, we will pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. You can send your prayer intentions to our Twitter handle at Drew Mariani Show. Jake will be monitoring that. You can email me, or of course you can join us at 888-914-9149. Tell one other person. You have about 30 minutes to do that, and we'll expand that spiritual family, and we'll pray for God's mercy and protection for the healing that you need and whatever other intentions you might need. You know, we talked a little bit about China a few moments ago, what their ambitions, what their long-term goals are. And I often say this. I've had the great privilege of traveling almost to 50 different countries around the world. I've you know, spent many a month away from the U.S., and I've been able to consume a lot of different media and absorb a lot of different cultures. We here in the U.S., we don't pay a whole lot of attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. I think that's you know, I don't blame you. You know, it's you don't get it on your mainstream media unless you go to resources or sources that may give you a different look. If it doesn't relate to us, we don't really care what's happening in South Africa or, you know, in the Middle East or some other area, right? Like, for example, when Russia hacks into our pipelines or into our meat supplies, then suddenly we care, right? But there are things going on elsewhere that will eventually impact us. And there's a story that I'm looking at, I'm observing right now to see where it could lead. And this is a giant mosque being built. There's a huge mosque being built right now in Strasbourg, France. And Strasbourg is a beautiful area that has gone back and forth between France and Germany for centuries. And the National Catholic Register, they reported that there's a Turkish Islamist group called, I think it's Mili Goros, if I remember correctly, Mili Goros Association. It's translated, if you take the translation of it, it means national vision. And they apparently have some ties to the Turkish government, though they deny they do. So what they're doing right now, they're building what's been dubbed as the largest mosque in all of Europe. It's going to be 118, you know, they're going to have these minarets that are 118 feet high. It's going to compete with the skyline views of the Strasbourg Cathedral, which is only 466 feet high, and once the world's tallest building. So controversy erupted after Strasbourg City Council. They approved paying 2.5 million euros towards the construction of the mosque. And the city's, you know, exempted from France's very strict separation of church and state. And they financed 10% of the construction cost of churches and synagogues in the past. But with Mili Goros mostly subsidizing this, you know, a lot of French are wondering whether or not Strasbourg went too far. And according to the Register, you know, the Confederation claims that they have now 600 mosques throughout Europe, 600 of them, and around 150,000 members. And it operates 70 places of worship in France. I talked about this in the past, the spread of Islam into Europe, especially in France and in Britain and a lot of other places. But that's not all. The Turkish president, you know, Erdogan, he's proposed that the EU, that Turkey be allowed to build a Quranic education center in Strasbourg, which would entirely manage Islam in Europe following the Turkish model. So what's this mean? Why should you care? What's it portend for the future? I'm joined right now by a woman. She wrote a book called From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. Her name is Daria Little. She was with us in the past. Actually born and raised in Turkey as a Muslim, and she found herself leaving the faith. She became an atheist as a teenager, and then, like many, you know, there's this search that begins for truth. We all have it in our heart. We all want to know, does God exist? Is there a higher power? Why was I made? What's the purpose of life? And looking at those questions, she eventually made her way to Christianity. And that door led her into the Catholic Church. She's now in the Church of Christ Established. She's got a PhD in political science. You want to learn a little bit more about her? She's got a website. It's DariaLittle.com. DariaLittle.com. And she's here to give us some perspective on this story. Good to have you back, Daria. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, Doctor, remind us of how much of Europe the Ottoman Empire once controlled. Maybe we should have a little bit of history here, give people a perspective of what it was like at one point, where we are now, and what we're now seeing.
Okay, so Greece was under Ottoman rule, and most, I'd say 30% of Eastern Europe, and the Ottoman armies sieged Vienna, which is almost, to the middle of Europe, as we know, four times and failed four times. And most of, obviously, the North Africa, which has a lot of ties to Europe. So it was quite the expansive empire. And for most Americans, this is just a history a long time ago. But in the old world, memories go deep and far. So for most Turks, this is yesterday, and there is that imperial pride, right? Like in England, that imperial pride is gone. You know, there is some left, but it's mostly colonization shame and whatnot, but that's not the case in Turkey. And I think we see kind of how that kind of pride about the past and this desire to bring back the past can play a role in today's foreign policy, which is Erdogan's foreign policy.
Yeah, so speaking of Erdogan, his ambitions to me, they almost seem neo-Ottoman, if you will. Does he want to see Europe, you know, vanquished by Islam? And I don't even know if Europe's in a position right now to resist him. How do you read that?
Why not? I mean, no. Nothing changed. As far as Islam is concerned, their great mission is to convert the whole world to Islam, whether by force or, you know, through peace. It doesn't matter. Like, whatever means works is Muslims are willing to, Muslim governments, I shouldn't say Muslims, because obviously not right. all Muslims are right. In his way of thinking, but Muslim governments are willing to use the means necessary to convert the world. Now, in the Ottoman Empire, they tried by force and succeeded in most places. And, of course, they were very good diplomats, and they knew how to run places, hence the success of the Ottoman Empire for centuries. But now, I think Erdogan is aware that he can't do it by force. But as you mentioned in your introduction, then he can maybe, he can use this vacuum Christianity left behind and fill it with Islam. Then he doesn't have to use force.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing left in Europe. It's like it's spiritually dead. Yes, there are beautiful cathedrals, but we know cathedrals can be knocked down and gotten rid of. Those are not, you know.
Yeah,
those
no.
are not. Yeah, the faith is gone. Yeah. So there is this vacuum. Secularism has nothing to fill it with. And then if they can fill it with Islam and they can convert people, actually it's the Jesuit way of conversion, right? You
right.
know, they
mm-hmm.
have schools, they have centers, and they have all these schools. In America, too, this is not in Europe. I mean, let us not be naive. Like, there are hundreds of such schools in America as well. So, yeah, why not? I mean, of course they want to spread Islam, just like we should want to spread the true faith.
So where's Europe in all this, though? I mean, I was sharing some of the numbers, 600 mosques right now around Europe. Why haven't Europeans done anything to stop this? Do they care? Are they concerned? I mean, what do you think?
I think a lot of Europe is naive about Islam, especially the left, because there is this idea that Islam is somehow demonized because of the church, right? Like, the true Islam is peaceful, and it's all these a few extremists, which is not true. I mean, obviously, if you have studied Islam, the Quran, Muhammad's life, you can see that this is a violent religion that is not for equality. So a lot of the people are naive, and some just don't care as long as the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a kind of mentality. It's like, hey, we can all fight against Christianity together, whatever is left of it. But I think they're just underestimating Islam, basically. And I don't know how they can do it, because they have suffered a lot more from the problems with the mass immigration. And, I mean, you know what happened in France.
Yep.
They have suffered a lot more. But I don't know if they have passed the point of no return at this point or not.
Yeah, you know, I often wonder what happens with the rise of Sharia law and courts, and how that will ultimately play out as it infiltrates countries like France and other nations of Europe. Do you see that coming at some point in the future?
Yes, I think I've heard that if there is enough adherence or there is enough demands, that's democracy, I suppose, that people can willing to subject themselves to the Sharia court instead of the secular or civil court or whatever. I know it happened a few times in Britain, and there are many cases, like, for instance, honor killings or like similar things are look kind of was kind of turned a blind side.
Mm-hmm.
Blind eye, because it's their culture, it's their religion. Who are we to judge? I mean, this is, of course, this is going to happen when you don't adhere to a universal truth. Then, right. You know, it's their religion is that, our religion is this. Like, it's very hard to kind of keep the law and order in a relativistic culture, because then who decides what is right and what is wrong? I think that's what we are seeing, the fallout from the relativistic worldview.
Well, Daria, I want to thank you for being with me. I only have a short time with you today, but I also want to get people connected to your book. If they want to get that, what's the best way to pick that up?
From Islam to Christ, you can pick up from Ignatius.com and, of course, from Amazon and wherever else you get your books from.
Can I ask you a question? You may not be able to answer this, but, you know, I'm always intrigued by people who follow the truth to wherever it leads them. And, of course, it led you into the doors of the Catholic Church. There are reports in Africa, reports in the Middle East, and lots of different places of Jesus Christ appearing to many Muslims, many people that aren't Christian. And he's teaching them things of a higher theological level. He's inviting them to convert to the faith, to follow him. He's appearing in dreams. This has happened in Egypt. It's happened all over the place. Have you heard any of this? I mean, what's happening in the Muslim world are you hearing reports of Jesus actually appearing to some of these people?
Yes, you would hear it very often. I mean, I think there are several reasons, but first and foremost, most of the Catholic Church dropped the ball in our missionary efforts, and these people still need to hear the good news. Protestants are doing all they can, but, you know, they don't have the fullness of truth. So I think the Lord is filling the gap we created, which he doesn't need us. He wanted to work with us. So that's one reason, because, I mean, Catholic missionary effort is almost all dead in Muslim worlds. And secondly, it's such a big decision, and it's such a hard religion to convert from. I talk about this a lot in my book. It's a religion of fear, and that fear does not let you go. You're so afraid criticize Islam. So you almost need a supernatural kind of slap to wake you up and push you over the edge. I had a similar experience. I didn't have, you know,
really?
Kind of a vision that, the Lord, like, I couldn't make up my mind, even though I was an atheist. Like, I didn't want to live with the consequences of becoming Christian in Turkey.
Wow, yeah.
So that was the final thing. Again, it's in my book if, you know, the listeners can
go
and read
it. Tell me a little something about it, because I remember I was go ahead. No, you go ahead. Share your story.
Yeah, okay, very quickly. So I couldn't make up my mind. Even though I'm an atheist, once I converted, I would be considered a traitor in Turkey. And I couldn't get any government jobs, you know, obviously lots of family, friends, and such. And I was going to classroom one day. I'm a junior in college at this point. And I saw this vision that I was a little girl sitting in the middle of a meadow and playing with toys in my lap. I saw a little girl. I didn't realize it was me at that point. Mm-hmm. And two hands came down from the sky, and they were trying to give me this gift, but I could tell that it was like out of the world kind of gift, wrapped beautifully, glowing, more than anything I could ever imagine. And this little girl turned up and said, I don't want that gift. I have these little toys to play with. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so I'm seeing this vision. It's like, 10 seconds. And I was like, are you stupid, little girl? Like, how can you even compare the little toys you have with this gift you're being offered to? And then I realized that's exactly what I am doing. Like, I was being very short-sighted, thinking about, you know, the job and, you know, friends and family, whereas, like, I was being offered an eternal gift that
that's
I could
beautiful.
Never imagine. So that was my experience. A lot of people have much more vivid as they see our Lord, our Lady often. So, yeah.
Yeah, when I was working on a documentary in Rwanda. It's a little tiny landlocked country in Africa. They call it the Switzerlands of the Africas. And there in 1981, there were reports of visions of the Mother of God. She appeared to 8 kids in a school. But one of the kids that she appeared to, it was a young boy named Emmanuel Segastasha. And he was actually he was a Muslim. He was out picking beans in a field. And Jesus began to appear to him. And Christ taught him they are Father. He taught him things of a higher theological level that this child who has really no education could possibly know. And it convinced the local bishop, the Bishop of Butare at the time, of the fact that these visions to him were authentic and real. He converted, of course, to the Catholic faith. And then soon I began to hear accounts of a multiplication of appearances of Muslims who have encountered Christ in unusual ways and in unusual dreams. In fact, when I return, I'll share some of those stories with you. My thanks to Daria Little. Be sure and check out her book. You can get it online at all major bookstores, From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. Her website, darialittle.com. I'll be back.
Now to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we'll pray the chapel coming up in about 10 minutes or so. Feel free to join me. It's 888-914-9149. You know, I love these stories of how God manifests, you know. And it says to you, it says to me, sometimes when we're weak in our faith, He does exist, right? He does exist. God is always reaching out to us, no matter where we are in our walk in life. I was praying about this earlier today. I was thinking about it. You know, there are times where I'm on top of the mountain and I am so deep into my spiritual life. And there's other times where I'm not, you know, and there's dryness or there's disconnect or there's the distraction of life. It can be really difficult. And I just thank God for the ways that He has shown Himself, revealed Himself to me, especially through the sacraments. Today I was able to receive both the sacrament of reconciliation. I met Christ today in the sacrament of mercy. He was only hidden by the priest. And I received Him, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the Eucharist. I mean, what a gift that we have here in this country. I happen to know the Lord, and I've happened to see things that are really hard to get my head around sometimes. Food multiplying, statues weeping, visions of the Mother of God in jungles. I mean, it's been pretty amazing. But God reaches out to those, to every one of us, every single one of us. And there are reports, you know, we talk about what happened in Africa, you know, to Emmanuel Segastache, where Jesus appeared to a boy picking beans. Soon the Mother of God would appear in the heart of this jungle and have a prophetic series of prophecies warning about, you know, a great genocide that would happen. And true to her prophecy, you know, the visions began in 81. It wasn't until 94 that we saw, you know, the Rwandan genocide unfold. But the Virgin talked about the return of Christ like Faustina did. She talked about the new diseases that would rise and spread. She spoke about the threat to purity in our culture. That all comes out of this church-approved apparition in Kibeho. That's God reaching out, you know, once again with an urgent message to mankind. It's the gospel message. It's a message of conversion. It's a message for you. It's a message for me. And you say, well, what about those who don't know the faith? Well, for at least the past 10, maybe 15 years, maybe a little bit longer, reports are proliferating about Muslims who are converting to Christianity through dreams. You know, some have visions, some have apparitions. Yeah, absolutely, just like Emmanuel Segastache. In fact, before I share this dream phenomenon, I'll tell you what happened in 1968. Years ago, I did a documentary called Marian Apparitions of the 20th Century. And I've got a friend, Bob, if you're listening, I'm going to give you a call. He really wants to get this message of Zaytun, Egypt out. And I had the privilege of speaking to him. He was there. I spoke to a woman named Pearl Zaki who witnessed the Mother of God. She appeared on top of the dome of a church in 1968. And this church, this Coptic Orthodox church, was right across the street from a firehouse. And these fire guys are hanging out, you know, like they normally do at night. And they look up and there's this woman. And they think that she's going to jump. They think there's a girl on the roof who's going to commit suicide. So they call out everybody, and people gather. They try to talk the person down, only to realize it's not a woman. It's not a girl committing suicide. It's actually an apparition. It's a luminous figure. It's the Mother of God. It was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, legend has it that Zaytun was a place that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, when they fled the Herod and the massacre of the innocents, that they stopped in Zaytun on their way into Egypt. And maybe they even lived there. We don't know. But here the Virgin Mary comes. And over the next 2 years, from 1968, I believe, to 1970, the Virgin appeared and 250,000 people witnessed her. 250,000 people saw her. And these were Jews. These were Muslims. These were Christians. These were Catholics. You know, these were people of all denominations, believers and non-believers alike. They all witnessed her. And the phenomenon was accompanied by all sorts of, you know, phenomena. There was luminous doves that would fly at the night around the Virgin Mary. There would be this powerful odor of, it was almost like an incense, a perfume that would waft through the people who would see that. And here's the really bizarre yet super cool thing about this. If you were there, you would see the Mother of God. If you were there, she would be visible to you. I find that so awesome. There's only a few places in the history of apparitions where that took place. Zion 2 in Egypt in 68. In the Soviet Ukraine, during times of great persecution for the underground church, Virgin appeared as a towering figure to people who would risk their lives. They go to these open field shrines to celebrate the Mass, and she would often appear. She appeared in Manila at one point in time there was this, the president had put out guards and tanks and told them to open fire on the people who were there having a rosary crusade, and Virgin appeared, and the officers wouldn't do that. Of course, Batania, Venezuela, a place I've been to frequently, and I've been present when the Mother of God has appeared. And then, Zaytun is one of my favorites. Zaytun is a place of unbelievable phenomena. Here's the thing. You know, there's actually photographs of the Blessed Mother. There's actually videotape. There's footage of this. And it is startling. I mean, it really is quite amazing. She's this luminous figure against the black sky. The Pope, I think, of the Orthodox Church at the time, I think it was Kyrillos V at the time, he actually approved these as being of a supernatural character, as being authentic. So, but that's what's happening. So what's happening now? Well, as I said, for the past two decades at least, our Lord is appearing to Muslims. There was a California magazine. They released a survey. They interviewed about 600 ex-Muslims who are now followers of Jesus Christ, right? They've left Islam. And they talked about what happened. They said that Christ would appear to them at night. He would appear to them in dreams and visions, and that played a huge role in their conversions. You know, some have found there was a missionary in South Africa who reported amongst African Muslims, 42% of new believers, they came to Christ because of visions, dreams. They reported angelic appearances, or just hearing the voice of God. They would hear the voice of God. And, you know, they have no explanation for this. They didn't know who he was, right? They had no idea who he was. People in the Middle East, they report how they were healed through prayer in the name of Jesus. And again, this is, I just think, an extraordinary grace for our time. You know, dreams are important, too. I mean, I don't want to discount dreams. I mean, yeah, an apparition, super cool. Blessed Mother appearing, Christ appearing to Faustina, the apostles on the way to Emmaus. But the Lord used dreams, right? Think of Abraham. Think of Joseph, the father of the foster father of Jesus. I mean, think of how powerful his dreams must have been to know when to flee in order to take the Virgin Mary, and to be guided that way. So they're crucial, I think, right now in our own time. There was the case of a sheikh whose husband had been a general and a Pakistani minister of the interior, and she had this powerful conversion. You know, she had been brought up in the Muslim faith and believed that Jesus was born of a virgin but was not God's son, and yet felt moved to explore the Christian Bible, and that's where it all began. And began to have dreams. She found herself having supper with a man that she knew to be Jesus. He visited her. He stayed. He sat across a table from her. And suddenly the dream changed. And she described what happened there. Soon she realized that he was the Son of God and wanted to come into the Catholic faith. So thousands of people have reported these types of phenomena, including villagers in places like Morocco, followers of Jesus in Guinea, places you wouldn't even imagine. Talking of Malaysia, in fact, there was one case of a Muslim from Malaysia who saw her deceased parents, and they were celebrated in heaven. Jesus was in a white robe, And he says, if you want to come to me, come. And she did. And she converted. Another convert, this one from the Middle East, was lying in bed with a very severe headache. And a white figure appeared in the room. And she said the room was filled with peace. And he laid his hands on their head. Did it three times. Following morning, totally healed of the ailment that had, you know, crippled him for quite a while. And look, it goes on and on and on. I won't spend more time talking about it, but this is a phenomenon that's unfolding in our own day. And you may not be visited by Jesus. You may not come to you in dreams or apparitions, but he is reaching out to you. He's calling to you, as he does all of us. And one day, we'll be perfectly united with him. So why don't we go to the Lord now? Let's turn to him and let's pray. We'll pray our chaplet of divine mercy together. This is a prayer that Jesus himself revealed to St. Faustina, called it the chaplet, told her how to pray it, attached to it unbelievable promises. We know that grace flows through this. We know that the heart of our Heavenly Father, Father of mercy, is touched and moved by this. So let's pray for you right now. You know, God is reaching out across the planet, and he's right here when you and I are gathered together. So when I return, we will pray the chaplet of divine mercy. Stay with me.